From Wheeler Auditorium at the Enoch Pratt Central Library in Baltimore, this is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. It's Tuesday, December 4th, and as part of The Lines Between Us, our year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region, we've just screened here the documentary made in 2003 called Race, The Power of an Illusion. The documentary lays out how public policies and individual decisions shaped inequality over the course of decades. It wrangles at a national level with the issues we're trying to understand with our series, The Lines Between Us, at the regional level. We're kicking off a panel discussion now. Joining me are Diane Bell McCoy, President and CEO of Associated Black Charities. Welcome.
Thank you.
Bishop Douglas Miles, organizer of Baltimore's Koinonia Baptist Church and the clergy co-chair of Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, or BILD. Welcome.
Welcome.
And Michael Sarbanes, Executive Director of Baltimore City Public Schools Office of Engagement, also co-chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of the Episcopal Diocese of Baltimore. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So let me throw a question out to any of you. This documentary was released in 2003. We've seen a lot in the housing realm in particular in the 9 years since then. The surge of subprime loans, the housing crisis, the collapse of housing values, not to mention the election of our first black president. Have you seen anything in the last 9 years in the area of housing that moves us toward equality of opportunity? Or is this film today an accurate reflection of the system that's in place? Bishop Miles?
I think that, two things. One, we've moved to a place now where there's equality of inopportunity brought on by the banking crisis and what the banks are doing to all of us in terms of interest rates, lack of mortgage lending primarily for middle-income families. So there is equality of inopportunity in that sense. But I think the damage was done far before the crisis, in terms of creating the crisis in inequality by race.
Diane or Michael, any thoughts about this?
One of the most powerful things, I think, in the film is the way that advantage and disadvantage accrues over generations. So the fact that this was made in 2003, the things that it's highlighting in terms of wealth accumulation in the way that opportunity has played out over generations will take generations to change. I mean, I don't think there's going to be a big change to be anticipated in just a decade.
But I guess part of what I'd love to hear your thoughts about is which way the trajectory is going at this point. Because this documentary shows us such an ingrained system of government-devised redlining of how one generation after another builds on the wealth or lack of wealth of their parents, that it almost makes me think it's impossible to make progress.
I don't know that I believe it's impossible, but I would say that I think that we have a particular opportunity window of time right now. And I'm not sure how long that window will stay open. I'm a fanatic about data. And if you look at where this country is going, the demographic shift, we begin to look at where we stand as a country in a global economy and the dangers of what this historical pattern of institutional and structural racism has done from an economic perspective of ensuring that those of color have less. That as this country continues to become browner, I think that window of opportunity for us to understand our competitiveness and the fact that we really are all in this together, that the growing of wealth or assets for people of color is really about the benefit for everyone regardless, that this economic time and place is where we either understand that we will begin to benefit all or we will begin to hurt all?
I think two things need to be looked at. One, I think that much of what has been done could be undone just by intention. Just as it was intention, just as people of color were intentionally penalized for being of color. The banking industry could turn this around tomorrow by reverse redlining, by making property values more valuable in communities that are integrated, as opposed to communities that are homogenous, whether black or white. That could increase wealth overnight for a substantial number of people of color. Secondly, this society is not ready to have a real discussion about race. Not in Baltimore, not in Maryland, not in America. We're not ready to have a real non-emotional conversation about race. And that's what it's going to take to begin to reverse things.
Why would a discussion of race be non-emotional?
I think some of the emotion has to be taken out of it so people can start seeing how the discussion can operate in all of our self-interest, as opposed to just on an emotional level where we're screaming and howling at each other.
I just pick up on a couple of things that Diane said, and then what what Bishop was just saying. I think there are some opportunities now that are different historically in that there's a renewed interest in the cities, partly precipitated by the fact that the suburbs, it becomes harder and harder for them to work in terms of traffic and so forth. So there's a possibility of creating a city that comes together that actually is racially integrated and that has there is wealth formation that occurs as opposed to it being yet another chapter of exclusion on the basis of race. So I think that's a real possibility.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, and I'm with an audience in the Wheeler Auditorium of the Pratt Central Library in Baltimore. We've just watched the documentary Race, the Power of an Illusion, and we're discussing it with Diane Bell McCoy, President and CEO of Associated Black Charities, Bishop Douglas Miles, Clergy Co-Chair of Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, or BILD, and Michael Sarbanes, Executive Director of Baltimore City Public Schools Office of Engagement. I want to pick up on this point about what John Powell, the noted scholar, a point he made in the documentary, that the benefits of the system very often accrue to people who have not taken any personal action to harvest them. They just flow to them.
White privilege.
White privilege. I mean, first of all, do you all agree with that?
That's
how the system works.
Yeah, and I think there's a wonderful quote from Dorothy Sowell where she says, "I am responsible for the house I did not build, but in which I live." And I think that's sort of the situation that that we find us, particularly white people, find themselves in, is figuring out what do you do with this legacy.
This is a very complicated issue, I love the conversation. I love the lines between us, but I also just want to be clear. It's so complicated in terms of there's no one single answer. So as I say that, I think you don't know what you don't know. And so if you come from a standpoint and your world is one of privilege and you don't know somebody else's world, you have no idea because your lens are just based upon your experience, your exposure, and all the systems around that cater to you. So it's so deep because that means the policies that our country develops that are largely developed by white people of privilege and often male, as our Congress is an example of that, you have no sense of the world that this policy is impacting that goes beyond who you are.
One of our friends here asks this question. Why should structural racism matter to those who benefit from it?
Because it's a short term, because they don't benefit from it. When you do the numbers, when you run the math in terms of economically, what are we paying for the price of structural and institutional racism in terms of its impact, in terms of cost of incarceration versus the cost of employment. When you run the numbers in terms of what it yields, in terms of what it costs government to support, when you really look at the total, add up the numbers of what structural and institutional racism is costing us as a country to house and to do, it's not worth it. It really isn't. So it really is changing and understanding beyond personal racism, beyond that conversation, understand the economic impact of it. And then you understand it's hurting you even if you are white.
And I think that it's larger than just racism. I think classism plays a tremendous part, because by class there are people who are benefiting from the structural racism. The 1% benefits from structural racism. The 4% benefits from structural racism. And if we try to deny that, then I think we start off from a point of not honestly addressing. Somebody is benefiting from it, or else it wouldn't exist. And it exists because people make money off of racism.
Someone asks, can there be a regeneration of affirmative action, a reestablishment of it, or rather, what takes the place of affirmative action?
Real affirmative action.
Could you explain?
As opposed to what was billed as affirmative action, and what many whites now call affirmative action was really not affirmative action. It was taking down the barriers of discrimination.
Yes.
You know, I resent it when people say that I went to Hopkins as an affirmative action student. I had options beyond Hopkins. I went to Hopkins as an effort to further integrate Hopkins for other African Americans in Baltimore. So I resent it when people say, I was there as an affirmative action admission. Affirmative action in the beginning just meant leveling the playing field and understanding that 300 years of having to be better than just to get to where other folks used as a starting line was nothing more than just leveling the playing field. It was not giving me or my race any substantial advantages. It was just removing the disadvantages. And I get emotional, so hey.
Michael, how can Baltimore schools address the geographic segregation described as the generational result of racist public policy in the film?
One of the really powerful things that can happen is as the schools in the city improve, and the improvements in the last 5 years have really been historic, that map begins to change, and the possibilities of having more and more neighborhoods be places where, in a regional context, people would say, well, I want to go to that neighborhood. And housing markets that historically have been completely segregated housing markets can begin to become more integrated housing markets, thereby producing greater wealth. The schools, I think, play a critical role in that. There's a sort of a bootstrapping process where, by the incredible effort of teachers and principals and parents and kids, that quality is, you can have major improvements in the quality of schools, and then that has impacts across the board in terms of what happens in neighborhoods and just the sheer opportunities that children have to go on to higher education, to be college and career ready, and to succeed. So I think the schools are an absolutely necessary engine to this. I don't think the schools by themselves are sufficient, but the schools are absolutely necessary to reverse the pattern.
Can you identify an example of a public policy in Baltimore that is continuing or increasing racial inequality?
I was a part of a focus group at Hopkins where we were talking about health disparities in Baltimore. And I ran the litany of health problems in the African-American community just in Baltimore. And the researcher got a little bit peeved when I said, this would not be allowed to happen in any white community in America. The African-American community in Baltimore has the highest age rate, the highest other sexually transmitted disease rate, highest hypertension rate, cancer rate, highest infant mortality, chance of dying before you're 70. This would not be allowed to happen in any white community in America. It would be declared a crisis.
One of our audience members wants to add a question about mental health to what we've been discussing. Given behavioral outcomes in public schools lacking mental health wellness to identify and empower our youth with capacity building in this area, what will it take to address this problem for all races?
Two things, if I understand some of what's in the question. One is what happens in schools around addressing mental health. And a lot of that is around specific services and around having sort of cultures in schools and practices in schools that really help to identify when students are struggling and get them connected with the resources and get their families connected with the resources. And that's, there's a lot of work that is ongoing on that. The other thing just on the mental health question, I mean, one of the most significant findings in terms of when families were able to relocate from neighborhoods of concentrated poverty to neighborhoods of higher opportunity in the region, one of the biggest differences was in terms of mental health outcomes. It was dramatic in terms of the improvement in mental health outcomes when families were able to get out of situations of concentrated poverty and get into neighborhoods where they weren't dealing with all those that toxic stress all the time.
You lessen the impact of structural and institutional racism that is impacted on individuals and families day in and day out living in extremely poor neighborhoods.
Along that whole spectrum of mental health, the African-American community in most major cities are communities in grief, children grieving over the loss of parents from AIDS, from drugs, from incarceration, from broken families, males grieving over the lack of opportunity, women grieving over the lack of opportunity for them and for their families, and then a child sees his cousin killed on Friday, he gets to school on Monday, and the first thing he's asked for is his homework. And he's never given opportunity to unpack the pain that he or she has felt. So all of this plays together, and it plays back largely to this crazy war on drugs.
Let me close with a question from someone here who is addressing solutions to a large extent depend on getting past white resistance. What do you believe is the most effective way to do that? First of all, do you believe that that's essentially the situation we're in, getting past white resistance, and if so, how?
I think it's larger than that, and let me get on my soapbox for just 2 minutes. I think we baby boomers are going to have an awful lot to answer for. We were the best educated, best fed, most privileged generation in the history of this nation, and we have abdicated responsibility for leading this country to a different plane than where it currently is. We fell into the trap of the meism of the 1980s, and we're now reaping the whirlwind from that. And so I think that it's going to take all of us, those of us with gray in our hair, to reinvest ourselves for the next 10 to 15 years to the ideals that we said we had in the 1960s. If we had maintained the zeal of the 1960s and the high goals that we set then we would not be where we are now in terms of race and a whole lot of other stuff that's going on in this country.
We also have to make sure we make space at the table for that next generation that is passionate, that cares about it, because they have a different perspective to add, and it is the world that we're talking about.
Michael, I'll give you the last word if you can do it briefly.
No, I think that one of the opportunities is to really make the systems of advantage that we were talking about in the film, to make those visible, and then to make all of us together accountable for changing that at every generation and at all these different levels, at levels of policy and at levels of relationship and at levels mm-hmm. of actual personal connection, because we are deeply personally and emotionally invested in making mm-hmm. The society we're in much more just, infinitely more just than it is right now.
I want to thank our guest, Diane Bell McCoy, President and CEO of Associated Black Charities, Bishop Douglas Miles, organizer of Baltimore's Koinonia Baptist Church, and Michael Sarbanes, Executive Director of Baltimore City Public Schools Office of Engagement and Co-Chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of the Episcopal Diocese of Maryland. Thank you. The Lines Between Us airs every Friday at 9 a.m. on WYPR 88.1. We've got more information at linesbetweenus.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Thank you so much. Please stay with us on 88.1.